These voices made headlines this week.
The Republican claim to be the champion of the middle class are cruel hoax.
We're at the countdown, fellas. We're at the countdown where it makes a difference.
It looks like it was a very fast-burning fire.
Voices in the headlines, the sounds of the news this week, gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC News. I'm George Caldwell, ABC News, New York.
The thing that concerns me most is that many people in the country have indicated that they're not going to participate, and that they're giving up on the government or giving up on a concern that's most crucial to them or to their families. And I just hope that in this last 7 days, both President Ford and I can convince the American people that on November the 2nd, they're making a decision.
Jimmy Carter's concern was voiced in an interview from his home in Plains, Georgia, as he and Gerald Ford got ready for their last full week of campaigning before the presidential election on Tuesday. It was a week of almost non-stop activity for the two candidates as they crisscrossed the country in a last effort to convince the voters. ABC's David Garcia was with the Ford campaign as it swept through Arlington Heights, Illinois on Tuesday.
Without a doubt, the most enthusiastic crowd President Ford has met in this last campaign push. Several thousand people crammed into a multi-level area of what's billed as the world's largest shopping center, the Woodfield Shopping Center in suburban Chicago. It's the president's last campaign stop of the day. The president's voice a little hoarse as he told the crowd he can't think of a better way to end the day of campaigning than to see so many enthusiastic people, and you can hear him in the background. When the president mentioned Jimmy Carter, the crowd booed and began chanting, "We want Ford." The kind of crowd candidate Ford loves to meet. David Garcia, ABC News, with the Ford campaign in Chicago.
President Ford used his Chicago area visit to point out not only the differences between him and Jimmy Carter, but also the differences between his presidency and that of Richard Nixon's.
There's not an imperial White House, which means there's no pomp, there's no ceremony, there's no dictatorial authority. We've tried to run the White House as the people's White House, where individuals have an opportunity to come in individually or in groups and express to me their views and recommendations.
Mr. Ford's counterpart concentrated some of his efforts in the New York metropolitan area. ABC's Joe Templeton was along when the Carter campaign hit Hempstead, Long Island, on Thursday.
Here he comes, Jimmy Carter, surrounded by Secret Service agents, now moving into the hall here at Hofstra University. This is the field house. We're told a crowd of about 10,000 on hand here. They're jammed in the bleachers and are sitting on the floor. They're taking up most of the space on the floor. Carter now passing right in front of us, wearing a gray suit and a striped tie, waving, shaking hands with the crowd, now moving to the platform. Joe Templeton, ABC News, with the Carter campaign in New York.
At Hofstra, Carter spoke to that crowd of 10,000 people.
Republican claims to be the champion of the middle class are a cruel hoax. The fact is that the Republicans have always been a haven for special interest groups. In the last 8 years, we've seen corporate income taxes decrease 50% compared to the total. We've seen payroll taxes and individual personal income taxes increase 50% compared to the total.
The candidates for vice president were as busy as their running mates during the week. On Thursday, Senator Bob Dole was telling a rally in Billings, Montana.
When I listen to this baloney about Republicans lacking compassion and Democrats offering compassion and big spending programs, I frankly get a little annoyed. I believe that compassion is what comes from the human heart and goes to help and care for others. But the Democrat version of compassion comes right out of your wallet. That's their form of compassion.
The economy was also the topic covered by Dole's counterpart in Morgantown, West Virginia, Wednesday night, as Senator Walter Mondale told a crowd.
Unemployment this year costs the American people something like $55 billion at the federal level alone. It is the most expensive program in America outside of the Defense Department and Social Security.
Polls have shown that Mondale has been a greater asset to the Carter ticket than Dole has been to Mr. Ford's. And Jimmy Carter emphasized that point during an appearance at the airport in Pittsburgh Wednesday afternoon.
President Ford chose Bob Dole. And when you go to the polls and vote a week from yesterday, don't forget you're voting for a ticket. Carter and Mondale Ford, and Dole. And when you compare those tickets, there's no doubt in my mind about which one will do the best job to serve you for the next four, maybe the next 8 years.
What happens at the polls this coming Tuesday will in large measure shape the events of the next 4 years. Jimmy Carter knows it, and as President Ford told an audience in Cincinnati Thursday,
"We're at the countdown, fellas. We're at the countdown where it makes a difference for all the men and women, the young and the old. On November 2nd, some big decisions are going to be made."
Mr. Ford has said that if he wins, it'll be an upset. Jimmy Carter has led Mr. Ford in almost all the opinion polls since he got the Democratic nomination. But that lead has eroded. One of the pollsters making those surveys is Lou Harris, who told the National Press Club in Washington this past Wednesday,
"If Jimmy Carter loses this election, and I for one would not rule out that possibility here 6 days before this election, he will have booted by far the biggest lead in modern political history."
By this time next week, we'll all know. South Korea has been a strong ally of the United States for years, but some questions are starting to be raised as to just how much political influence South Korea wields in Washington. A current investigation, said to involve some 90 members of Congress, is underway to see if perhaps South Korean officials have tried to bribe the U.S. lawmakers in exchange for favorable treatment. At the center of the investigation is a South Korean businessman known in this country as Tong Soon Park. Park, who, by the way, is not related to South Korea's President Park Chung-hee, has been an influential figure in Washington for years. But the word this week was that he's on what's called an extended business trip outside of the country. Translated, that means he's not available for questions. Correspondent Jim Kincaid says another phase of the story may involve the Unification Church of the Reverend Sun Myung-moon.
ABC News has found evidence that points to the use of money received by Moon's followers in efforts to influence congressional attitudes and votes in favor of the South Korean regime of Park Chung-hee. Among the ex-Moonies ABC talked to, several told of being involved in concealed lobbying efforts in favor of South Korean interests.
Correspondent Kincaid made his disclosure on the ABC News program Perspective. Richard Nixon has lost another round in his fight to keep some of his White House tapes from being made public. On Tuesday, the U.S. Court of Appeals voted that those tapes used as evidence in the Watergate cover-up trial can be copied, broadcast, and sold to the public. Two things prevent that from happening immediately. One is that a suitable plan for distributing the tapes must first be developed. Another is that Nixon has appealed Tuesday's decision. In another development, one of the defendants in the cover-up case, John Ehrlichman, decided this past Thursday to start serving his sentence right away. His lawyer, Stuart Stiller, told us,
"Right now he's in the a place called the Federal Prison Camp at Safford, Arizona, and he's serving his two sentences that he has that are concurrent to each other. And I don't know precisely how long he'll be serving."
Ehrlichman was sentenced to a minimum term of 20 months. Appeals in his case are still pending. Another case dating back to the Watergate days was settled this past Wednesday. A federal jury acquitted former Senator Edward Gurney of charges of lying to a grand jury about a big political shakedown scheme. Gurney was bitter when he talked to reporters.
"He destroyed a United States senator and thwarted the people of Florida who elected me by the biggest vote margin that anybody has ever been elected in the state of Florida. They blackened my name, they besmirched my character. They ruined me economically. And this is what the great Department of Justice did. It ought to be called the Department of Injustice."
Gurney had been acquitted last year of five other charges connected with the case. The Florida Republican was the first senator in 50 years to be indicted while in office. Another case in the news this week dates back 45 years. It was then that a man named Clarence Norris and eight other black companions were arrested in Alabama and charged with raping two white women. They were convicted on flimsy evidence. After 15 years in prison, five of them on death row, Norris was released on parole and left Alabama in 1946. The case involving the so-called Scottsboro Boys ended happily for Norris this past Monday, when Alabama's current governor, George Wallace, pardoned him. Norris said there was a lesson to be learned from the years of injustice.
"Don't never give up. Always fight for your rights. Always stand up for your rights. Because your lives, stand up for rights.
Norris still has the option of bringing a lawsuit against the state of Alabama. Shipping traffic on the Mississippi is back to normal at the site of the October 20th collision between the ferryboat George Prince and the Norwegian tanker Frosta, but the inquiry into the crash continued this week. This past Wednesday, the coroner for the city of New Orleans, Dr. Frank Mingard, released the result of an autopsy he conducted.
The ferryboat captain's autopsy revealed that he had a blood alcohol level of 0.09 milligrams per cent, which is just a tad bit under the legal definition, 0.10 milligrams per cent, of being legally drunk in the state of Louisiana. So this amount of alcohol in his system, coupled with the fact that he was at the end of his 7 or 8 hour shift, the fatigue associated with that, and the amount of alcohol would definitely impair his ability to handle his vessel.
At the same time, the Coast Guard Inquiry Board heard from the pilot in control of the Norwegian freighter at the time of the crash, Nicholas Colombo. Colombo told of warning the ferry boat with blasts from his whistles.
When I blew the second two whistles, the ferry appeared to start to turn upriver, to starboard. And just for a short period, and then he started to come back to port. When I realized he was coming back to port, I sounded the danger signal, and I went full astern.
More than 70 bodies and 30 vehicles have been recovered from the Mississippi River so far. Some 20 other people are believed to be missing. Fire sirens shattered the relative early morning calm of the South Bronx section of New York City a week ago Sunday. The firemen arrived at a social club to find it completely in flames. The club was on the second floor of the building, and many patrons had to jump from windows to get out. 24 of them were injured, but they managed to escape. 25 others died in the club, most of them from inhaling the thick smoke. John O'Hagan is New York City's fire commissioner.
It looks like it was a very fast burning fire. It didn't burn for any particular, for a long period of time because there isn't that much charring damage done to the ceiling beams. So it seems that it started very rapidly. We were notified rapidly. We knocked it down in a hurry. Now, fires that start in ordinary combustible material don't burn that way.
New York police are looking for a man whom they think is responsible for setting the fire, apparently because of an argument he had at the club earlier in the night. Last July, an enterprising bunch of thieves tunneled its way into a bank vault on the French Riviera and made off with some $8 million in money and jewelry. This past Tuesday, gendarmes raided a number of places in Paris and other cities and arrested 10 men they say were part of the so-called sewer gang. A number of others escaped when they heard about the raids in a broadcast. At Kennedy International Airport in New York early Wednesday, New York police arrested three men they say were about to pull off a multi-million dollar robbery of a vault owned by the European airline Swiss Air. Detective Anthony Somato tells how the trio planned to pull it off.
What they intended to do was to get inside and bypass the alarm system and break into the vault area. There was about $80 million in the vault, which consisted of diamonds, emeralds, gold, banknotes, and cash.
The actual worth of what was in the vault was quite a bit less than that, as it turned out, but the take still would have been in the millions. A report drawn up for a congressional committee says that the federal government was less than effective in trying to find out what caused the mysterious ailment that killed almost 30 people in Philadelphia last July. The report says too much attention was given to the theory that the ailment was infectious, and inadequate attention was paid to the fact that it might have been something else, such as a poison. The report on the so-called Legionnaire's disease was released by New York Democrat John Murphy this past Thursday. And Murphy says safeguards should also have been taken to ensure that some deranged person wasn't responsible.
There should have been a survey made of mental institutions within 100 miles of Philadelphia immediately. The person, if this in fact was done, had to have a fairly sophisticated knowledge of chemistry and laboratory work, and also had to have a paranoia, a hate for things military.
One of the theories is that someone mixed the poison nickel carbonyl with dry ice and allowed the gas to seep into the rooms of the victims. Aspirin is the most common of pain relievers, but the Food and Drug Administration warned this past Sunday that in some cases, aspirin can cause more harm than anything else. The FDA's Wayne Pines told us about it.
The panel said that taking salicylates such as aspirin during the last 3 months of pregnancy can prolong the mother's labor and can alter the bleeding and clotting time in the mother and the baby. And therefore, the panel recommended that the labeling should include a warning not to take salicylates during the last 3 months of pregnancy, except under the advice and supervision of a physician.
Pines stressed that the FDA report is a preliminary one dealing with over-the-counter pain relievers. A month is a long time to be without food, especially if it's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. 28-year-old Bruce Collins of Walnut Creek, California, was picked up at sea this past Monday. He'd been adrift on a raft since his sailboat sank in a storm last month. Larry Clark of the Coast Guard in San Francisco told us a plane spotted Collins' raft.
A man crawled out of the hole in the canopy and started signaling the plane. The Coast Guard cutter Campbell arrived on scene a little bit before 3 and recovered Bruce Collins, the lone survivor of 3 that had been on that life raft since the 27th of September. The two other people on it, Camille Arthur and Jim Mahola, had died and were buried at sea by Collins.
At a news conference on Wednesday, Collins told reporters,
"I never had a lot of faith in religion, but I did a lot of praying, and it calmed me down, kept me calm, and I just kept real calm and felt that there was a lot more out there than just humans."
The search for Collins and his raft was touched off on October 18th when a professional sailor from San Anselmo, California, Durrell Miller, and a companion, Nancy Perry, also of San Anselmo, were picked up from another raft by a Japanese freighter. All of them had been aboard the sailboat headed for a Hawaiian vacation when the storm hit. Miller and Perry had been taken to Yokohama, where Miller told reporters what the ordeal was like.
Hunger as a pain in the stomach ceased to exist after the third day. And it was just thoughts of banana splits and the main topic of conversation was food, you know. Everything hurt. Everything.
Miller said except for feeling responsible for Miss Perry, he was ready to die every 5 minutes. There was a unique political development in Africa this past Tuesday. We heard about it from ABC's Cliff Saunders in Johannesburg, South Africa.
A new state was born in Africa last night, but so far it is recognized only by itself and South Africa. At midnight, Transkei, one of South Africa's 8 black homelands, became independent. In his independent speech, Paramount Chief Matanzima called on the international community to recognize his country and said it was as independent as any other country in Africa. Only one of the other 7 black homelands in South Africa intends accepting independence. The other 6 have said independence is not a viable proposition and their people want political rights within white South Africa. This is Cliff Saunders, ABC News, Johannesburg.
The first major international reaction to the move came at the United Nations later in the day, when the General Assembly voted 134-0 to declare the Transkei independence invalid. The United States abstained. Protestant leaders in Northern Ireland are worried that more terror is in store for Ulster because of Thursday night's murder of one of the IRA's women leaders, Moira Drum. Mrs. Drum was killed in a hospital in Belfast. ABC's Brian Black gave us details.
She'd been in hospital here in Belfast undergoing an eye operation and last night was talking with other patients by her bed in a small ward. 3 youths, one dressed as a doctor, made their way to the ward, singled out Moira Drum and pumped 5 bullets into her at point-blank range. She died on the spot. Despite an immediate follow-up by police, there's still no sign of the killers, although the provisionals say they were members of extremist Protestant paramilitary group. Brian Black, ABC News, Belfast.
In 1972, in an interview with ABC's Hillary Brown, Mrs. Drum had expressed her feelings about death and her love of country.
I really think it's a glorious thing for anyone who's given their lives for Ireland. I do. I think it's a glorious death.
Ironically, Mrs. Drum's family had been making arrangements to get her out of the hospital in Belfast at the time she was killed. A Belfast newspaper had published her whereabouts earlier this week. There was a strange reunion in Thailand a week ago Sunday. We heard about it from ABC's Norman Batorf in Bangkok.
Japanese widows clad in black kimonos chanted over the graves of their husbands, and a group of former POWs and their World War II guards walked across a historic bridge here in Thailand today. The site of the reunion was the bridge on the River Kwai, where an estimated 30,000 Allied troops and some 120,000 civilians died while building the famed and infamous bridge. Today's reunion at the River Kwai was primarily designed to help wipe out the lingering hatred between the former Japanese Imperial soldiers and their Allied prisoners. Said one British ex-POW, "You never forget the dreadful things, but you adjust to them. You have to start again." This is Norman Batorf, ABC News, Bangkok.
A group called Worldwide Research Institute studies environment-related problems in the world for the United Nations, and it has concluded that a doubling of the world's population by the year 2000 is no longer expected. Dr. Lester Brown heads the organization and tells one of the reasons why this is so.
The changing role of women in society has been a major factor, particularly in the industrial societies. In Western Europe, the labor forces in a number of countries now are 40% or more female.
Brown says the study also shows that population growth has declined because of the widening availability of family planning services and a growing desire by people to use them. Two men have been in the forefront of the 1976 presidential campaign, but a percentage of the votes they will get will have been won by their wives, Betty Ford and Rosalynn Carter. For Mrs. Ford, the campaign has been especially grueling. She is troubled by arthritis, and there has been her recovery from breast cancer. Mrs. Ford says it is her fight against cancer that she considers one of the most significant accomplishments of her 2 years as First Lady.
I'm very glad that I brought cancer to the forefront so that it became a word in the English language. It wasn't a dirty word. It wasn't a word that people tried to hide. Women no longer are ashamed of having mastectomies. They talk about it. And I think this has made great progress, and I feel that I've saved many lives.
Mrs. Ford told ABC's Ann Compton she feels excellent. In a couple of days, Mrs. Ford and Mrs. Carter will know where they'll be living for the next 4 years. Either way, says Mrs. Carter, she wouldn't have missed the campaign for anything.
It's been an experience I would not have missed. I've been in the whole country and met people everywhere, and problems that people have become important to you. You can read about them all you want to, but they don't become real until you're there and see them. So it's an experience I would not have missed, but I'm looking forward to November the 2nd.
And so went This World This Week, and the voices in the headlines. Voices in the headlines, the sounds of the news this week, gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC News. Written and produced by Gil Lungeon. Executive producer, Tom O'Brien. Directed by Bill Mayo. Engineering by Cy Kontrowitz and Clark Ranger. Special effects by Ed Blaney. I'm George Caldwell, ABC News, New York. Voices in the Headlines is a production of ABC News.